Hey everyone, welcome back to the Empowered Advocate podcast and welcome to May 2020. I don't know about you guys, but for me, April felt like the longest month ever. Let's be honest, actually, the whole year of 2020 has felt pretty long, but whatever this season has looked like for you, whether you are hunkering down at home and you are keeping your family in order and you're caring for them and teaching school maybe, or if you're going to work as usual, if you are on the front lines in the healthcare industry, whatever it looks like, thanks for what you do. Hang in there. You're not alone. And our prayers are with you. So I'm glad you chose to tune in with us today on the podcast. If this is your first time listening, welcome. We're glad you're here. This podcast is for you. It's to help empower listeners to advocate for life at every stage. And this conversation that we get to share with you today, I really enjoyed. I got to talk with Herbie Newell, and he is the president and executive director of Lifeline Children's Services. And if you've never heard of Lifeline, I'd encourage you listen to this whole episode because it's an amazing organization that we actually get to work with on a regular basis at the Pregnancy Network when it comes to helping our clients or the women we serve to make an adoption plan if they are interested. Lifeline's the one that we call. So Lifeline does a ton of work in the United States, but also in 25 other countries, and they help empower churches to love on their communities through adoption, orphan care, foster care. It's really incredible to hear Herbie talk about it and the way that he got to where he is now. So we're going to get started, and I'm excited to share this conversation with you. Let's do it.
Mary, it's a privilege to be with you today and just to talk about this such an important topic of life and the sanctity of life.
Yeah, I feel really privileged just to be talking with you. It's been really neat to read up on just all of your life experiences and the things that you've walked through. And then, of course, to read your writing, I've really gained a lot from it as well. I just kind of want to get started. I'll say when I was reading your bio, one of the first things I noticed was that you started out in accounting. And I just thought that was kind of funny that you're here now. So I'd just love to hear about the road that led you to Lifeline and how that all came about.
Yeah, so I'll try to give a brief synopsis of that road, and it certainly isn't the traditional road to leading, one, a nonprofit, two, leading a ministry, but certainly not a pro-life ministry. But to be just, to go back at the age of 14, I had one of those moments where I literally knew that the Lord was calling me into some type of full-time ministry. At that time, I didn't know what it would be. I didn't know what it would look like. It wasn't like at 14, I said, hey, one day I'm going to be in pro-life ministry. But I knew it was going to be some type of gospel-driven ministry. And as I just kind of walked that out and sought even counsel from pastors and from ministers and from friends and, you know, even just older mentors, the thing that kept being pressed upon me was that in any type of ministry, it's about leading people. And there's so many different components that seminary and that studying the word are not going to prepare you for. And so they really encouraged me to look at either a business degree or something similar. And so when I went to college, you know, my wife and those who know me well would tell you I am the classic textbook overachiever. And so when I went to college, the business department had two degrees. One was a accounting degree and one was a business management degree. And as I was looking at the syllabus, I realized that the accounting degree had all of the core components of the business degree, but it added some. And so I said, well, you know, if I'm going to get a business degree, let's go for one that's going to get as many, you know, that's going to kill two birds with one stone. So I did that, went through college, ended up getting my master's in accounting. It's really a master's of business administration with a specialization in accounting. And the Lord took me then into youth ministry. And so my heart at that point was really for middle school students and for high school students as well. And so here I am, you know, master's in accounting, and I'm working with youth. And the Lord led through that process of ways that I could continue to work with youth and still study or and still work along my degree. So I took a job as a CPA, set for the test in the state of Alabama. I was working as an accountant. At this point, my wife and I are married. And that was really, I think, when the Lord started to take us on a journey. And that was my wife in high school, had many friends who had pregnancies. Several of them became single moms. Unfortunately, several of them also took the life of their child through abortion. And so that just gave her this strong both empathy, compassion, and call to get into pro-life ministry. And so when we got married, her first job right out of college, newly married, was as the assistant director or the crisis pregnancy center director of our local pregnancy center here in Birmingham. And she really excelled in that. It was her calling. And so at night, you know, we would come home and I would talk about all the debits and credits and the things that I had done in the financial world. But you could easily see she was bored to tears. And then our whole dinner table would come to life when she began to talk about these clients that had come into the center, how she was able to point them to the gospel of Christ Jesus, how she was able to minister to them. And just to be honest, Mary, everything about the trajectory of our family began to change around the dinner table. No longer was I as passionate about debits and credits and accounting, but trying to help her pray through and think through how we can minister to these women and how we could, you know, help them have opportunities to be able to succeed, to choose life and to succeed. And long story short, that just really led us to question vocationally, what was the best thing and best place for me to be? And at that point, 17 years ago, we found this job and this opportunity to lead this incredible ministry of Lifeline Children's Services.
That's amazing. And just as a side note, it just makes me think of how important that time around the table is. You know, you talk about that being the place where your hearts both changed. I think that's really cool. And just a good encouragement for families to talk about their work and their hearts around the table, because God can use that. So tell us, for those who are listening and don't know, what is Lifeline Children's Services? What is the scope of those services provided? And what does it look like from location to location?
Yeah, and so even just to double back for a second to what you said about the dinner table, because that really leads into your next question, is, you know, the dinner table is such an important place for families to gather. You know, now, fast forward 17 years, I have three children. I travel a good bit. We're a busy family, but we make sure that we protect that dinner table as much as abundantly possible. We'll turn down opportunities, even getting with friends, in order to make sure we've had enough time around the dinner table to invest in our children, to pray together as a family, to seek God's face. So for us, the dinner table is not just about nourishment. It's about family, and it's about coming together. It's about syncing up. It's about sharing our emotions and our dreams. And I say that's really what Lifeline is about, is giving children the opportunity to have moments around the dinner table with family. Because there's so many kids here in the United States and around the world that the reality of family is not theirs. And there could be lots of different reasons that reality is not theirs. It could be because their family of birth ended up being broken, and the foster care system had to come and take them out of that family of birth and place them into temporary shelters or temporary foster care. It could be because they were born into a system of poverty or a systemic system of abuse or neglect. It could be because they were truly unwanted. And so no matter what that is, Lifeline's ministry is to wrap around vulnerable children and to give them a glimpse and preferably a hope at opportunities for family. And so we do that through a myriad of ways across 12 different states in the Southeast. The first and foremost method that has been there since 1981 when we were founded is to minister to vulnerable women who are going through unplanned, potentially unwanted, and crisis pregnancies, by discipling them, walking them through those pregnancies, leading them to the truth of life-giving options being parenting or adoption. We want to help them really explore what's best for them and their baby in those life-giving options. We also want to, where that woman wants to explore adoption, we want to provide godly Christian missional families for those children to live in those homes, to be a part of those homes and a part of those families and a part of those dinner tables. But it's important to us that we recruit missional families. And the reason we say missional families is because we want families that understand that adoption is not plan B, but it's plan A for them and for their child, but it's also plan A for their ministry path. And so if they adopt domestically, then they intrinsically have a ministry back to a woman because their child came from the womb of another woman and they need to minister to that woman. If it's simply just in the way they pray on a daily basis for that woman, maybe it's the way they communicate with her. There's all different spectrums that can look like, but that needs to be a primary instrument of the ministry for which they've been called to, is that woman from which their child came. Then second of all, we have our foster care and family reunification programs, and that's where we want to bring kids that have been displaced from their biological families. We want to help them get back into their biological families through parenting classes, through mentoring of birth families. You know, all our foster care system in the United States was intended to be temporary and is intended to be a time for families to get their act together and get their kids back. And so what we realize is government was never intended for life change, was never intended to come alongside these families. And so we want to bring the local church to bear so that these families would be able to see, one, the love of Christ, to see it exemplified through the local church, but then also be given the skills to get a step forward in being able to bring their children back into their home. And so that's foster care, family reunification. We also have international services through international adoption, and we work in about 18 countries where there are orphans that are in need of homes. Many times these orphans are older. Many times they have some form of a special need that they're dealing with. Many times it's because a country has very strict abortion or one-child policies, or maybe they have opportunities where so many families are unable to provide for their children and domestic adoption is not an option. And so we have inter-country adoption. We also have orphan care. And what we believe is that the 153 million orphans around the world need the intervention of believers. And that's not just meant for the U.S. church. It's meant for the global church. And so through our unadopted orphan care, we want to teach life skills and job skills to orphans through the mechanism of the local indigenous church. And so that's our unadopted ministry. And then last, but certainly not least, we have our education, our counseling, our support ministry. And that's where we want to come alongside families that have adopted, families that have fostered, children that are foster children or children that have been adopted, and love on them with a care concern of Christ through counseling, through support, and through educational services.
Wow, that's amazing. And one thing, a common thread I heard throughout everything you were sharing about is the emphasis on the church, the local church, to kind of be the hands and feet. I was doing a little bit of reading and some of your other writings a few days ago, and one thing you wrote was, if the first call they, being the government, if the first call they're making for help is to a local church, then we've done our job well. So can you maybe give some examples of what it looks like how the churches specifically are being empowered to do those things, you know, to support children, to support birth mothers? What does that look like for the church as far as like practical steps?
Yeah. So, you know, I guess where I just start, Mary, you know, when the Lord even called me at the age of 14, I really felt this, you know, distinct love for the local church. It was in a local church that I was raised. It was in a local church where I was discipled. Obviously, I was being discipled at home, but I was further discipled through the local church. I was able to make connections with other believers, to be held accountable. You know, the church is the body of Christ, and we believe as a ministry that we were not formed in order for more and more people to know what Lifeline Children's Services was, but we were formed in order that more and more people would be attracted back to the local church, and ultimately would be attracted back to the gospel of Christ Jesus. when you look out throughout the Word of God over and over, you see that there's so much attention placed on that local church. And so as we look at ministry and as we look at caring for the vulnerable, caring for women going through unplanned pregnancies, caring for kids in foster care, caring for orphans, we realize that the mechanism that care needs to be carried throughout is the local church. And so one of the things that we want to do is come alongside of pastors, come alongside of lay leaders and lay people, and give them the opportunities and give them the skills to be able to meet the most basic needs of child welfare, of orphans, and of vulnerable women. And so a lot of that is just giving them tangible ways and to meet the needs that you see in these populations. So one of the ways in 2009 that we saw that happen, and it's just continued to replicate and multiply throughout the Southeast, is when a local church partner here in Birmingham shared with us that they wanted to do a foster care drive. And the plan was on Labor Day, they were going to preach a sermon, and the sermon was going to call people that were interested in foster care to come and to try to rally together to get trained and to come to Lifeline and to Alabama Baptist Children's Homes, another provider here, and that together we would get them licensed and place children in their homes through foster care. And as we were talking to this pastor, you know, I really felt the Lord burden my heart to share with him. And I told this pastor, I said, I don't think that this is replicatable. I don't think that this is going to be best if we lead the people to nonprofit organizations who are going to ultimately lead them back to the state. I think as a church, we need to go directly to the state and we need to say, how can we help you? And instead of even doing a foster care drive, let's ask them what their biggest needs are. And so that led to a meeting with this pastor, the director of this other organization, and I, with the two largest counties in Birmingham, and just literally allowing this pastor to say, I feel like my Lord is asking me to meet your needs. What are some ways that I can meet your needs? And I tell you, the first reaction from both of those county offices were tears rolling down their cheeks as they said they had never been invited into a church and asked, how can we help you? And their response was, we're always told how you want to help us. We have more backpacks than we know what to do with right now from churches doing backpack drives. No one's ever come and asked us what we need. And so through that conversation, that dialogue, it did become apparent that there was a need for foster families. And because of that need, and because the county was able to be a part of that, there was a drive done at this church, and over 800 people came forward interested in being a foster family. Now, what ended up happening through that transaction is right now, some 11 years later, whenever those two counties have a need, one of their first calls is back to that local church. And so what we believe that we're called to do is to put churches in places where they can meet the basic needs of child welfare, of women in crisis. And so a lot of times that means just humbling yourselves and coming before someone and saying, how can I help? And a lot of the things we want to train churches to do in this space is to realize we've got great ideas. It's easier sometimes for us to see the issues and the problems in child welfare or problems that a single mother are going to face, but it's a whole lot more humble to go in and say, how can I help you? And help lead those counties, help lead those women, help lead those systems to seeing how you may have ideas to how you can help, but ultimately to first ask them, how can we help you? And we've seen that just replicated over and over and over again through family reunification, through ministering to birth parents, through starting other foster care programs throughout our country. And what's neat even about that, Mary, is we had an opportunity to start a program called Families Count through a local church in Wisconsin. And the local council there that was in charge of child welfare, as well as the juvenile court judge, were at a meeting. And the meeting was over Zoom with some of our team. And over that meeting, they said, we are not interested in religion. We don't want religion pushed down our throat. We don't believe in the Christian God. But if you are willing to stand up for our families and our children, then you are more than welcome in our system. Now, fast forward some 5 years later, that is one of the most thriving child reunification programs that we know of in our sphere of influence. And that secular court judge and that secular system are continually calling this local evangelical church and now other local evangelical churches to meet their needs. And the gospel's going forth, lives are being changed. And so the first and foremost thing is we've got to be available, we've got to be humble, and then we've got to ask the right questions.
I love that. And that's a hard thing to do. You know, you talk about being humble and being able to accept the fact that the needs might be outside of our comfort zones to meet. And so I think that's such a beautiful example of how God can use that step of humility. And I would imagine, so I know on our end at the Pregnancy Network, we've really tried to shift our language to, you know, when we're talking to churches to say, hey, we are here to help you carry out the Great Commission here in our city. And what we have found and what we've seen is that people tend to get way more excited when it's the ball, I guess, is in their court, you know, for lack of better words, you know, giving them the opportunities to say, hey, this isn't, you know, the Pregnancy Network's ministry. This isn't like our little thing. This is your ministry. This is the church's ministry. Have you, what have you seen, I guess, on the end of churches that you've worked with? Do you see that same excitement kind of taking hold and spurring people onward? What does that look like?
Yeah, I've seen both. I think for the most part, I definitely see churches that are excited because for a long time, they've wanted to know how to get their hands dirty in pro-life ministry. How do they get their hands dirty on caring for vulnerable children? And they just haven't known how. And a lot of times they've just turned that ministry over to local nonprofits and they just point their people to those local nonprofits. But really, when you look at the heart of the churches that we work with, you know, most of their heart is we want to minister to our people well, and we want to minister outside of our walls well. We just don't know how to do that. And so when we can step in and say, let us give you some tools, let us give you some avenues where you can do that well with your people and attract all the attention back to the church, Typically we find that churches are excited about that. They're open to that because one of the things we know that churches are called to do is to also, you know, to equip the saints to go in and make the gospel known in tangible and real ways. And so that's an exciting thing for most churches. I also think it can be daunting, you know, because a lot of churches, and we hear this a lot, you know, a lot of the clients that we work with are broken individuals. And Mary, I know you know that as well from the work you do in Greensboro. The women that come into your center are broken. Many times they have many vices that they're holding on to. You know, the pregnancy, while, you know, evangelicalism may think that the pregnancy is the biggest deal, it's actually one of her minor deals. She's dealing with a lot of other issues and a lot of other baggage typically. And so churches sometimes are a little skeptical about what will happen. I remember one church in South Carolina, we were talking about, again, our families count, family reunification class, and they asked a question, and it was very real, and it was, when we do these classes, how many of these women and how many of these men are smokers, and what do you do about that? Yeah. And we had to tell them, well, yeah, a lot of them are smokers, and what we end up doing is we have smoking breaks, and we ask them to go out in the parking lot and smoke, and this church said, I just don't know if we could condone smoking at our church, and what other issues might they bring into the church, and could there be domestic violence situations? And the thing that we remind churches over and over again is when you start to minister to broken people, you're inviting yourself into their brokenness, you're inviting themselves into their messiness, and that's the call of Christ. And so we've got to prepare our people and we've got to prepare our churches that the call of caring for broken people is very, very messy. And if you look throughout the Gospels and you see Jesus's ministry, it was constantly to the most broken. And you saw the Pharisees, they were all the time coming and saying, how are you dining with sinners and tax collectors? You know, why are you with pagans and why are you with these people? And we got to realize that when we step into pro-life ministry, it is messy. And so I would pray that our churches are ready for that. And like I said, for the most, the majority of churches are ready. They're anxious. They're ready to get their hands dirty. For many of our churches, the heart is willing, but the flesh is just a little weak.
That's good. Well, Herbie, I'm curious, from your perspective, how Lifeline maybe has been impacted by coronavirus in terms of the needs. Have the needs that you're trying to meet changed in any way? I know, like on our end, we've seen a lot more activity outside the local abortion facility, much higher numbers. And it seems that the industry is really kind of playing on the fears associated with this virus and being pregnant in the midst of a global pandemic. And so we've got a lot of women who, like you were just saying, who have so many things going on in their lives already. And then you add this to the mix. What are you seeing on your end of things? And has that affected at all, I guess, Lifeline's response to it?
100%. Unfortunately, we are seeing that this global pandemic is just adding another layer, like you said, of doubt, of trauma for many of these women. And so we are seeing an influx of ladies that are calling us, women that are seeking out our services, both from a counseling perspective, but also a lot more women that are seeking out adoption as an option. You know, I think a lot of women who, praise the Lord, were past the opportunity to get an abortion are coming to the realization that they probably aren't going to be able to make it as a single mom in this environment. And so we certainly have seen a lot more ladies calling us. I think that has really made us double down on the way we counsel those women when they come to us, because many of them are looking for a quick fix and a quick solution. And we have to make sure that they are prepared that, you know, adoption is a lifelong decision. It's not something to be made in a rush decision because of a global pandemic. It's something that needs to be thought through, and the cost really does need to be counted. We also, Lord willing, or thank the Lord, have seen more women just calling our numbers and getting in touch with our social workers and our counselors at a much more rapid rate. The doubt is there. The fear is there. And for many, they don't want to seek out an abortion and they need help. And so we've changed our services to really cater more towards how do we meet the needs of single women, the practical and tangible needs. It's something we've always done, but those practical and tangible needs are so much greater right now than they've ever been. Instead of just asking for some help with rent or some help with electricities or utilities or some, you know, some baby clothes or, you know, a prenatal vitamins, the needs are, hey, I don't even know how I'm going to eat myself. I don't know how I'm going to make it through the next week. And so those needs have certainly just absolutely have grown and have intensified. And so we're really having to change our services. Also, knowing that many of our hospitals are catering to COVID-19 patients, we've had to send counselors and social workers into hospitals to be a support person for women in some very, trying times and some very difficult times. And so that's certainly something we've had to think through. That's certainly something that we've had to pray through and look at of how we're going to meet the needs of these women in this growing time. And then the second piece in the way we've seen our ministry really be affected by COVID-19 is certainly through foster care. Unfortunately, when kids were taken out of school, were placed into homes that were already questionable, where they were already experienced some level of abuse and neglect, that has just skyrocketed. And we see right now more and more kids that are being displaced from their homes. But unfortunately, because most of our states are in social distancing, it's extremely hard to bring new foster families to bear. And so we need more foster families, but we are still trying to find the right mechanism to bring them to bear on behalf of these children who are desperately needing respite care.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing across the board is just that every business, organization, ministry is having to alter how we do our ministry in some pretty drastic ways. But I mean, it's great to hear that those changes are being made. What would you say? Now, I'm assuming how does Lifeline receive its financial support? Is it all private donations? How does that work?
Yeah, so we are funded about over 50% of all of our support comes through private donations. You know, obviously some of that is private grants, as well as some minimal church support, but mostly private donations. The other about 45% comes from fee-for-service arrangements, mostly on social services that we are providing and other types of things. But we certainly have seen all of those support areas really be affected and constricted through COVID-19. I think initially for the first couple of weeks, donations were a little bit higher for us. I think folks really had nonprofits on their mind and how they would be affected. I think And I'm praying through, not just for Lifeline, but for all of our vital nonprofits and nonprofit ministries, that the Lord would continue to sustain these ministries. Because unfortunately, I think that the financial hardship on many of these ministries is going to happen in 6 to 8 months. I don't think that year-end giving is going to be as strong in 2020 as it has been in years past. Because people just aren't going to have the bonuses that they've had in the past. They're not going to have the extra expendable income that they've had in their past. And so I pray and hope that the Lord will continue to water our nonprofit ministries and our churches. And I would just encourage anyone who is listening to this podcast that's in a position to be able to give and to give generously, to give to your crisis pregnancy centers, to give to your churches, to give to those foundational evangelical Christian ministries, because the next 6 to 8 months are going to be extremely difficult for those ministries.
Yeah, I think, you know, the timing is ideal for this conversation. I think, you know, in the coming week on May 5th is going to be Giving Tuesday Now. And so it's this global campaign running to help kind of give a boost and to empower all these nonprofits that you just spoke about who are going to be hurting a little bit and experiencing, you know, in the coming months, the impact of this virus. And so that's one thing, you know, if you're listening, consider where you might be able to invest in these eternal missions for Giving Tuesday Now. You can do that for the Pregnancy Network, but also Lifeline or, you know, your local church, wherever. Just be praying about that, how you can invest in those missions and really make that eternal investment that'll outlast yourself. Well, Herbie, before we end our time together, I'd really like to hear just a little bit about, you talk about your book, Image Bearers. And so I know that it focuses a ton on this idea of a pro-life ethic. So what kind of got you started, interested in putting together a book on this topic? And what was really the kickstart behind it that made you actually put pen to paper?
Well, I think, you know, certainly going back to even the very beginning, those dining room table discussions with my wife, thinking through just all of the ways that we saw life discarded and neglected throughout our country. And really, I think, too, the thing that the Lord really impressed upon us, you know, 20 years ago when we were eating dinner and praying for my wife and her clients, was that these women are created and formed and fashioned in the image of God. And many times, yes, the baby is the most vulnerable, but they're just as vulnerable. Many times these women are coming from single parent homes. They're coming from places where they're impoverished. They're coming from lack of support. And these are lives that are absolutely made, designed, and fashioned in the image of God. And so many times they feel neglected. They feel forgotten. And I think that, you know, just really germinated in my mind that yes, we need to fight first and foremost for babies in the womb who are voiceless and who unfortunately are losing their rights faster and faster in our country and around the world. But we also have got to start standing up for life that's also born, for children with special needs who are living every day with special needs, for adults that have special needs, for those women who are victims of trafficking and human trafficking. We need to speak up for them. You know, we need to speak up for those who in our midst, who are in a minority status, who have had systemic racism placed upon them, and so they're not able to get out of those systems. I think even right now in a COVID-19 world, when you look around and you hear over and over and over again that the number one most infected group are African Americans, because they lead the country in heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity. Well, why is that? And as I really started to even pray about that through this COVID-19 idea, I realized that while our schools and our public places may no longer be segregated, unfortunately, in our houses of worship, our churches are some of the most segregated places. And many times, you know, we are separate and we are not equal. You know, and so we need to remember that all people made in all shades and all races and all ethnicities and all cultures are made in the image of God and are worthy of our advocacy, are worthy of our support. And so we need to We need to speak up against racism because that's being pro-life. We need to speak up for the defense of women. You know, when we see how many women are being abused, how many women are being belittled, we've got to speak up for women who are abused and women who have been battered and mistreated physically and emotionally. We need to speak out on behalf of those women. And then ultimately, we need strong families. We need families where the dinner table is the priority again. We need families where the mom and the dad are working in unison to love and nurture their children. We need to stop allowing the internet and TV to disciple and to train and to bring up our children. But a pro-life ethic is we start to speak into our children and we start to love them and care for them and grow them up in nurture and admonition. And so, you know, really just walking through this ministry over the last 17 years, it's been seeing how many pro-life issues there really are. And then, of course, the one that we tackle as a ministry each and every day is that pro-life issue of children who are already born, who are vulnerable. The 153 million orphans around the world, the almost 500,000 kids in U.S. foster care. These kids are made and formed in the image of God, and it's extremely pro-life to stand up for them and to advocate for them.
That's good. And I think it can feel a bit overwhelming when you think about all these issues that come into play. I know sometimes when we think about being pro-life, a lot of people hone in on the abortion issue, and rightly so. But it's so easy, like you said, to overlook that mother or those children who are already born who are in, you know, maybe abusive situations or in foster care. And I love what you mentioned about how you said this earlier in our conversation, how when we're, you know, for families who are adopting specifically domestically, they need to have that ministry mindset of they are going to be loving on that mother too, as much as possible, rather than having this idea that, you know, well, adoption is coming to save the day and rescue and, you know, be the hero. You know, it's so easy for kind of some undertones of racism to come into that. So I love that idea. And one of the things I thought of when you were talking about that, so at the Pregnancy Network, we have a mentorship program, and our goal is ultimately to give every woman who comes to us the opportunity to enter a mentor relationship with a woman in the local church. And one time, it's been 3 or 4 years ago now, but I was at VBS at my church, and I was in my classroom, you know, just taking care of some housekeeping things. And a woman walked in, and she was volunteering and she was handing out some materials. And I was like, I've seen her before. Where have I seen her? And I couldn't figure it out. Well, it wasn't until like later in the week that I finally figured out that she had been one of our clients at the Pregnancy Network. And she was partnered with a mentor, a woman within our church. And what had happened was they had become so close. She was now bringing her children and they were a part of the children's ministry together, and she was volunteering and she's a part of the body of Christ. She's a believer now. And I just thought that was such a beautiful example of what our the end of what we want, you know, not just to say, okay, she chose life for her child. Great. Have a good life, but saying, no, come into, we want to like enter into this life with you and walk together and provide a safe place for your child, but for you too. And so I always think about that story, and there's so many others we've seen, but I just think that's such a great example of what our heart, all of our hearts should be for the unborn, but also for the mothers and the fathers and everyone who's impacted by those decisions. Well, Herbie, thank you so much for talking a little bit just about your background and about Lifeline. Is there anything else you would say to someone who's listening who is wondering what it looks like to live a pro-life style? What would you say to them about getting their feet wet and getting involved?
Yeah, well, the first thing that I would certainly say that is easy, and I know at times it sounds trite, but it is so abundantly true, and that is just to pray. And hopefully, even from listening to this podcast, you can know that my story in extreme activity, even to the place of writing a book on the pro-life issue, it all started around prayer. I mean, the very first thing that Ashley and I did around the dinner table was literally to pray by name for these women that were coming into the center. And so sometimes right now you may start praying and you don't even have names, just to pray, because the Lord knows the name. He knows the identity of these women. He knows the identity of these children. And just start to get on your knees and pray to the God whose image they're made in, that he will wrap around them, that he will protect them, that he will secure them, and that he will get them to the right place. I think second, and I think it's so important, especially for any women that are listening, your local crisis pregnancy center needs you. They may need you as a prayer warrior who's in the back of the center just praying for women as they're coming in. They may need you to go into the counseling room to share your story, to share the gospel, to give a pregnancy test, to care for women in the midst of their pregnancy. They may need you to help with classes for women that are going to parent. They may need you to help mentor or disciple these women, but to be available to your local crisis pregnancy center. And I think true to just start looking and going, okay, Lord, how can you use me? And I think that's a scary prayer, because I want to warn people that the moment you begin to ask, Lord, how will you use me in pro-life ministry? He will guarantee you answer that prayer. The question is, are you going to be ready? And so I think we've got to first just start to pray for women and children who are vulnerable. Second, we've got to take the step to start volunteering with our local crisis pregnancy center or other ministry that is pro-life in our community. And then third, once we're ready to take that next step, is begin asking the Lord to show us where he wants to take our family. That may end you up in the journey towards foster care, towards adoption. It may end you to a journey of running a crisis pregnancy center or getting vocationally engaged. But I promise you, when you begin to ask the Lord how he wants to engage you, he will get you engaged.
Well, Herbie, thank you so much. That's a good word, and I think a perfect place to wrap up. For those of you listening, thank you so much for tuning in. If you'll check out the show notes, we'll have links to everything that we've mentioned in this conversation, and also a link to Herbie's book, Image Bearers. Hope that you'll grab a copy, and we'll also put some references to Lifeline so you can learn more about them. And Herbie, I will just say, we have loved our relationship with our local Lifeline chapter. I know we have workers that will come in pretty regularly to have meetings with our clients to talk about making an adoption plan. So we're just so appreciative for that partnership. And it's just really neat to see how so many different arms and ministries can serve in different ways, but come together and help one another in those different ways. So thank you so much. And I hope you'll stay safe. You and your family will stay safe during this time.
Thanks for having me, Mary.